The ancient Central Americans dwelt at the center of a dazzling and complex cosmos. From this position, they were acutely receptive to the demands of their gods, who had a peculiar bent toward demonism and darkness. The cult of human sacrifice is a pervasive theme in this study. And apparently, as you read the Book of Mormon, from the 2nd century to the 4th century, time of the death of Mormon, human sacrifice become a pervasive perversion of the ancient people. There is also a mask pool whereby gods, and there are some 1,600 enumerated in the pantheon of the gods of Central America, these gods could exchange identities and regalia by putting on a different mask at different times. Now, Burkhart Wright, Brundage, explores the myths behind these and others in the Aztec pantheon in a book that he recently published called The Fifth Sun. From the annals of the Quetzalcoatlan, we have this little piece of poetry that's kind of indicative. In the year 13 reed, so they say, it first appeared. The sun that now exists was born then. This is the fifth sun. Its date sign is for movement. It is called Movement Sun because on that day it began to move. The old people say that in this age earthquakes will occur, and there will come starvation, and we shall perish. The fifth sun refers to the fifth and last and final age of the earth. Now, some of the source materials we're utilizing, and not enumerated in tape 116, that is the preparatory tape for this particular series, we have the work edited by Verhorst on the four masterworks of American Indian literature. And those of you may be quite familiar with the Handbook of Middle America, the Middle American Indians, volume 12 to 15 is now available. And also recently available now is the works of Diego de Landa, the one responsible for many of the book burnings near Merida in Yucatan. We have the indispensable works of Sahagún. There are 12 volumes of the Florentine Codex, and one of my experiences as a young man was in 1950 and 51 to visit the University of Utah, where Diblo was doing the translating work. There are the translation and commentaries also on the works of Sahagún. His towering importance can be seen from the references made to him in the recent works edited by Edmondson on the 16th century Mexico. There's also the tremendously important book on the plumed serpent by José Diaz Bolillo, very much an important document, available after 1964 and only available in Spanish at the present time, and a very important book that can be referred to again and again are the books by the Dominican Fray Diego Duran, particularly his Book of the Gods and Rites and the Ancient Calendar, recently available now in paperback. There's also the standby, the one we just quoted from the Annals of the Quetzalcoatlan, and the Legends of the Sun, and the History of the Mixtec, and also the History of the Mexican Books of Pictures. Some of the sources drawn upon include Mendita and Tezozomoc, Motitlan, the Franciscan friar who entered into this Central American area in 1541, Alarcón, Ponce, Pomar, the three volumes of Garbey's writings on Nahuatl, and the five volumes of Sellers' great study, available mostly only in German, and the two volumes of Bayer's collected articles, and also the Archaeology of Mexico, and the 12 volumes of the Studies of the Culture of the Nahuatl, published by the University of Mexico, and Bodo Spranz's books on the collection of the ancient codices of Mexico. I obtained my personal copy in Guadalajara some years ago. It is a most useful reference as well. And then a few years ago, the catalog of the codices of ancient Central America, we referred to that one and a great deal of the recovery and discovery of these ancient codices in tape 116. And then the works of Richard Andrews, published by the University of Texas. Also, the Facts and Artifacts of Ancient Middle America by Kurt Musser, is a very useful book for those who are doing any type of exploration and study of the Central American archaeology. The works by Bremen also on the Aztec's image is a useful one, and Nickberg and others on Precolombian American religion have been most useful. Now, the Aztec universe, and that in Central America and throughout Mesoamerica, was one of five directions. In fact, it was in terms of five directions and the center and four cardinal directions in which the world and the heavens and time revolved for the ancient Central Americans. To this fundamental structure of the universe, all things had to conform. A city, for instance, could be laid out as a microcosm of the universe. The capital of the Mexican Aztecs had as its focal area the Temenos of the gods, which was an enclosed compound crowded with temples and other sacred buildings, symbolizing the universal center. The principal temple enshrining the two gods was correctly interpreted as standing in the east and therefore being oriented toward the west. Four axial roads leading east, north, west, and south emanated from this focal area and thus pointed to the four quarters of the city. This was not merely an urban convenience of the Mexican Aztecs or the earlier predecessors. It was a necessity imposed upon pious men everywhere who knew how to read the grand design of the universe and who desired to conform to them in their works. The rational ordering gave meaning to the earth, and the system expressed first the sacredness of the world. The earth upon which the individual walked, in whatever direction he might travel, in war or in peace, warned him of its divine probabilities and its inner purposes. Thus the earth possessed a variously qualified holiness that was made clear in the climaxing metaphor of the four directions and the center. And the five ages of the world culminating in the fifth sun is likewise represented in this order. The rational ordering gave meaning to the earth, and the system expressed first the sacredness of the world. The earth upon which the individual walked, in whatever direction he might travel, in war or in peace, warned him of its divine probabilities and its inner purposes. Thus the earth possessed a variously qualified holiness that was made clear in the climaxing metaphor of the four directions and the center. And the five ages of the world culminating in the fifth sun is likewise represented in this order. The centrality gave the Aztecs a sense of urgency and importance. Things of moment could take place only in the center. This made him acutely receptive to divine demands. And remember, the center is represented by the earth. The four directions in the center assured him of the flawlessness of the entire structure. The surface on the earth counted as the first level, and above this were the various heavenly terraces, each the abode of some astral or atmospheric presence or of one of the great gods. The uppermost tier was Omiakon, the seat of divine authority. The sun, the moon, and the stars inhabited lower courses. Beyond this, the ancient Central American priesthood had inherited a view which was theological and intellectual. This view they used to explain the function of the sky and its structural foundations in the earth. And according to this scheme, there were 13 ascending levels which made up the whole. Between these 13 levels and 1,600 gods that had finally arrived in the 13th and 14th century revolves all of what we know about Central America to date. Now, in the ruins of many of the ancient sites in Mesoamerica and even in our own Southwest, there appears a peculiar edifice called the Tlatelolco. It was the ball court. By 300 B.C., the games were fully developed. In the Aztec myth, a game of Tlatelolco that changed the course of the present eternity or time was once played between the gods, the god Quetzalcoatl and Tezcatlipoca. During the game, which was to decide who of the two was to be the sun. Now, Tezcatlipoca changed into a jaguar, thus achieving victory. The appearance of the jaguar motif here is instructive, for that animal with its spotted coat represented to almost all peoples in Mesoamerica through nearly a 3,000-year period, both the night sky glittering with stars and the interior of the earth. Even more mysterious to men than the world itself was the nature and direction of its changes. The earth can be seen and walked upon, but time is never more than an impalpable reality at best. The impulsions of time are easily and everywhere apparent, from the sequence of the seasons to the birth and death of all organisms. Time, a dark current, it sweeps men along, and their complaints mean nothing to it. What men object to is its tragic directionality. They know that the essence of time is change, and this indeed is the structure of life. But they are shattered when they contemplate the fact that what begins in vigor marches only and always towards decay. Now, the Aztecs did not have our power to turn away from time. They prepared in the wastes of eternity stopping places where the spirit of man could briefly dwell before pressing on. Theirs was a very human response. It was a way of accumulating into a handy bundle the tribulations and sins of the years, which became supportable only because of the certainty that at the end of the period it could be put down, abandoned, and a new one taken up. There were five of these suns or ages. They were not cyclic, each repeating the other, but were unique and unrepeatable. They were limited in number five as a maximum number. There will be no more. They have been alike only in that each was an important cosmic experiment ending in collapse. The first four were past eternities or times. The fifth is the present one. Taken together, they make up the complete history of time, of gods, and of man. This eternity or time will end in earthquakes, an interesting parallel to the Book of Mormon, which will swallow all things, and the stars will be shaken down from the sky. This will be the final end, and it will occur when the earth has become tired, when already it is all, when already it is so, and when the seed of the earth has ended. Most of this comes from Sahagún, fantastic person and character. We haven't time to deal with his life and contribution. Briefly, it was treated in tape 116. Now, no peoples are ever without awareness of the fact of creation throughout all the world, but many do not take it very seriously. However, the Central Americans always look backward, and because of this, they did take creation seriously. The first categories of creation in their legends dealt with the creation from pre-existent matter. Now, Chipacatli was the personification of chaos, or the unstructured matter out of which the cosmos was created. The upper part they elevated to make the sky. The lower part remained to become the earth. And from the hair of the earth lady, the gods fashioned trees and tall grasses, and from her skin flowers and short grasses, and from her eyes springs, and from her mouth rivers and caverns, and from her nose valleys, and from her shoulders mountains. The second category of the creation legends was creation by divine decision. In the beginning, says this ancient source, there was only the high God, who could be referred to as the self-created. More generally, he was called Lord of Sustenance, because he was the source of all sustaining power. He is always depicted as an old man with a beard. He was the creator and lord of all things. And even up until Aztec times, to about the 15th century, he needed no sacrifices, temples, or cult statues. He lived with his wife, Lady of Sustenance, in a paradise in the highest of the 13 heavens. Some said that he fashioned the waters from the sky and that he created the earth simply by breathing on it. But an ancient Mexican version of this particular legend says that he deputed the act of creation to his four sons. The myth, however, points out that the four immediately delegated their creative mandate to two, who were the most clearly seen of the gods. One of these was Quetzalcoatl, and the other Tezcatlipoca. One good, one evil. In the third category of the ancient creations and legends, there was the creation by blood sacrifice. Sacrifice was the mechanic, an inner logic of the universe, almost a god itself. This concept permeated the whole of Aztec mythology. Whether cosmogenic or otherwise, it was also the central preoccupation of the Aztec state and its predecessors. The created cosmos was finite, its strength waned rapidly, and it must constantly be revivified. This renewal could be accomplished only by sacrifice, which thus become a ceaseless activity and an incumbency on those who desired the continuance of the cosmos. Now, the early original sacrifice of one of the gods was only the great exemplar. A series of sacrifices had to follow. Gods, earth, and sky were entirely dependent upon blood sacrifice to maintain them. If there is to be life, there must be sacrifice and sacrificial death. All of this is presented to us in a remorseless Aztec dialectic. In the fourth category of the creation stories, there's the creation by victory. In this fourth and last category, the element chosen to define the act of creation is sheer power, the power made evident in the state and in its heroic leader as he overrides all opposition. In thus and similar legends of creation, the opposition is generally thought of as a malevolent group of individuals, numerous, deadly, and determined. I think you can readily see some of the parallels to the Mormon doctrine of creation there. But if we erase the high god or the goddess from the picture, we can see that sacrifice as a central cultic act was of a holiness superior to that possessed by ordinary gods. The deities that haunted the cosmos were all thought to be subject to the overarching logic of blood sacrifice. Having been born out of it, they must be inescapably need to submit to it and all its mandates. Their divinity can only be tested against it. There is one God, the Son, whose account belongs in both the third and the fourth creational categories we just mentioned. Now, he was a distinctive deity and is called in one of the sources the solitary God. The Son's name, or name given to the Son, was Tuantia, he who goes forth shining. Behind the name is the concept of a heroic emergence from the darkness. It was foretold that a son of this god, or the son of the sun, would someday come to renovate the world. The mystery of the sun's rising is thought of as the reincarnation of the dead sun in the person of his son and successor. Each day's rising sun, therefore, is different, though connected by descent with the previous one. This particular source or legend with which we were concerned relates to the appearance also of this final sun, this final period, and the role he plays in it. The first element of the placement of this ancient legend seems to be in Teotihuacan, the well-known archaeological site just outside present-day Mexico City. In shaping the primal sun myth, the Aztecs cast this ruined capital as a dead city of the fourth period. It had come to glory and passed on during the fourth period. A third element is the reduction of the universal conflict between the sun and the stars to one confrontation, that between the sun and one star in particular, the confrontation between the evening star and the morning star. The morning star incorporates in himself the totality of stars, and he becomes the gigantic symbol of all that is dangerous, dark, and cold. His demonic quality is well brought out when we learn that the darts he hurls down to frost as they fall to the earth, and that he becomes in the underworld the god Cetl, the personification of cold and ice. The evening star was to metamorphose and to become by an act of self-sacrifice the sun himself. Thus, in spite of its unpretentiousness, it carries the true splendor. There are some interesting parallels there. Lucifer was called the son of the morning. There is also a paradise, and in all ages man has delighted in exercising his talents from fantasy in this depictions or his depictions of paradise. Now, Lord of Sustenance and his consort, situated in the highest of the 13 heavens, they're all the gods were created, and there they had once lived in original blessedness. subsisting on corn, the holy food. In the center of this land of eternal summer and flowing water stood a tree, whose boughs were not supposed to be broken or its flowers plucked. Exotic birds corralled among its leaves without ceasing, and all was joy in this world. The gods were cast down out of Tamachian to take up various stations allotted to them in the underworld, on the earth, and in the sky, a delegation of authority and office and occupation. Now the story could be told even in more detail. One version recounted that it was the deity called Obsidian Knife Butterfly who alone disobeyed the divine command, for which she was hurled down to earth to become the demonic being she is. Parallel there to Eve and the fact she became mortal and fell. However, the notable feature of this ancient myth and legend is that it concerned not with the fall of man from grace, as in the biblical tale, but with the fall of the gods, or of a single god. We interpret this ancient story of paradise in the following way. Joy and loveliness are the proper and pristine sort of things and state of things, and the loss of this state was a demonic act, the first such, and resulted in the present order of things here on the earth in this fifth time. Nothing is said about the possibility of the gods ever recovering their first innocence. Salvation from the present order of things, in fact, seems to be impossible, even for these divine beings. The corollary of this is that man inherits from his divine superiors a world worsened by their wicked actions, and this was henceforth the one immutable structure of the cosmos. Someone of divine authority had fallen, and as a result, worsened the conditions. Now, the individual who seems to have occupied this position of a great fall is intimately associated with a curious couple we have already had occasion to notice. The confusion which envelops them in our sources stems from the two facts. It would have seemed that they were once two individuals, a man and a wife, in some remote period, high gods, no different from the Lord and Lady of Sustenance. If so, they rightfully belonged in paradise. On the other hand, they were so antiquated by the time that the Aztecs borrowed some of these ancient legends, and so overlaid by the late levels of myth that they had dwindled to almost human stature. And as first progenitors, they assumed the role of cultural innovators. They are still situated in paradise, but it too has been brought down to a more earthly level. The two individuals, Chipactanol and Chochomoco, could be equivalent of Adam and Eve, for they do play the same role. They are said to have lived in the first time long before the flood. All men are descended from these two. They have lived in paradise, but had been cast out in the great expulsion mentioned above. This part of the story relates to the antique status of these two individuals who were once considered to be gods and dwelt with the high god and goddess. We find that they are the first humans and are thought to have been infinitely wise. As cultural heroes, they created the world of civilized men, giving him knowledge of herbs and curing. There was also a reference to where the palace was guarded by doorkeepers and gods, and men do not inhabit paradise unless, as in the case of Tolokan, they are selected by the god himself, or as knights, they have repeated the original solar sacrifice or given their lives. Now we might talk briefly about the quality of the gods and some aspects of their different manifestations. In the language spoken by the ancient Aztecs, the word for god was Tiltl. The glyph they used to invoke this word was the picture of the sun. The consonant with this is the fact that, when used alone, the word generally had reference to the sun, who is thus dignified as the god. In compounds, the word has secondary meaning, which is difficult, vast, and awesome, and dangerous, or it may have the meaning of genuineness and rareness. Now, in the early part of the year 1519, when the conquistadores arrived, at an anchorage probably off the Tabasco coast, the first formal meeting between the ambassadors of Moctezuma II and the party of Hernando Cortez took place.
because the year 1519 happened to be approximately the same as the year one read in the ancient calendar, a catastrophic interpretation was placed on this meeting by the contemporary peoples of the Mesoamericans, the Aztecs in particular viewing it as ominous. It is still necessary to speak of the Aztec gods and their predecessor gods in categories. In this system, gods will be considered explanatory. Some gods were effective, some providential, some focal. By explanatory gods, this meant those gods who were apprehended as a result of the needs of the inquiring individual. There were effective gods. These are those whose essence in their ability to move men, and not to thanksgiving or the like, but to passions and evolutions. Providential gods preside over the material aspects of men's lives, nourishing, clothing, housing, training, curing them, and then there was a last category of the gods, which are called focal gods, answering to man's social needs, his sense of identity, and the area of the locale of the individual. Now, Quetzalcoatl, who was the patron god of the city of Cholula, would be considered a local god or a focal god for that particular city. But elsewhere, he would have a greater role to play. The gods went through many transformations and had a mask pool. Now, in Tezcoco, most regal and largest of all the ancient cities of the Aztecs, there was a temple built by the great ruler, which was dedicated to a most unusual Aztec god, one said to have had no idol. No way was he represented. The pyramid had several levels representing the ascending stages of the heavens, and there were different degrees or different representatives of heavens. On the terrace, the shrine was painted black and decorated with stars. This signified not only that the god in question lived above the highest heaven, that, like the night, his mind and his deeds were unknowable. There were over 60 hymns in his honor. There was also another god, Tloki Nahuake, is reputed to have originally been a Toltec god, an earlier predecessor of the Aztecs, and this is indeed quite probable. His name is literally and translated as he who is the owner of near and the owner of close. The absence of any attempt to create a mask for him is interesting, and the only temple known to have been built for him was the one in Tezcoco. He was known by many other names: Our Lord, He through whom we live, the hidden and the impalpable one, the self-created creator of man, teacher and lord of creatures, lord of heaven and earth, and others. Then there was another, sometimes identified with Tezcatlipoca, or less often with the Lord of Sustenance. Tezcatlipoca, on occasion, is referred to by this same name, as if he had the high position of gods on earth. Now, viewed from this angle, this god appears to be an authentic god. Was he a friend of man? Hardly. He intended man's destruction. He mocked men and saw to it that all things decayed. There were declarations made by this one god that he was the god of the earth. At least this concept of the immanent one remains an important intellectual achievement and parallel to early Mormon doctrine. To be a high god and to stand as a fountainhead god, one had to be imperial. The best known of these paired gods were the Lady and Lord of Substance referred to earlier, and then the first man and the first woman on earth. One other god should be mentioned under this particular rubric of classification of gods because of his role as a cultural hero, a prime actor in history, and this is Quetzalcoatl. So in this first group of explanatory gods, we have the equivalent of God, the Father, and a mother god, the first man and the first woman on earth, and then the son of one of the first two gods, a man called Quetzalcoatl, or a god. Later on, we describe the fact that he was once human. The greatest god in the second group of the effective gods is Tezcatlipoca. Both in myth and in other sources, he was the adversary of Quetzalcoatl. And as in the case of the latter, however, there won't be time to devote a great deal of time to him. In this group, the affective gods, there are the daunting and horrifying gods in the ancient pantheon. No other people in history surpassed the Aztecs in the elaboration and promotion of such gods. Even the gigantic demons in the East Asian temples look almost insipid when compared to the famous Coatlicue, whose effigy has caused thousands of people and beholders to turn away shuddering. Now, the god of the morning star is another such prodigy of terror. He is depicted as wearing armor, a warrior dueling with the sun, and is generally painted with the vertical red stripes of sacrifice. Sometimes he has a death head. The first rising of this planet was always an ominous event. It was attended by great dangers to certain categories of people. The morning star was singled out to represent a whole range of fears that afflicted men. Now, we won't go into a total detail of the nature and character of a lot of these gods. The third category of gods were the providential gods. In this category belonged those deities who supported the people in their daily lives, were generally closest to them. And then there were the focal or local gods. These were the national, tribal, city gods, sometimes mascots, who brought luck to the society and summed up the essential constitution. That gives you an idea of the categories in which gods were considered. As I mentioned earlier, about 1,600 gods were involved. There was also certain cycles. The basic cycle, Chipacatli, was basic to the cosmogony of the ancient Aztecs and their predecessors. There were 8 different cycles. The 7th one is of interest. This is the Quetzalcoatl cycle. This is the most heterogeneous of all the cycles, but clearly reveals the basic theme of priestly wisdom and the validation of human culture. This probably coming from Quetzalcoatl's character as the god of air. Now, Quetzalcoatl is born in the highest heaven, and they're given his cultural commission by the two gods, Lord Sustenance and Lady Sustenance. Alternatively, he is also descended of the Earth Mother. So he was descended of the first originators, progenitors of mankind. He is created with creating men and women, credited with creating men and women, and brought into cultivation maize and maguey, two of the great staples. He invented the calendar, patronized all crafts and commerce. He was the archpriest and gave men rituals, ordinances, and penances. Quetzalcoatl was far traveled and had fundamental connections with the East, from where he came and to where he went back, according to the ancient sources. Now we go to one of the vast and looming features of a particular god in Central America, Tezcatlipoca. Sagoon placed Tezcatlipoca, or sometimes called Smoking Mirror, in a rather interesting category. He said, "It is of interest that this wicked Tezcatlipoca we know as Lucifer, the great devil, who there in the midst of heaven, even in the beginning, began war, vice, and filth." So Sagoon made this identification, a rather interesting one. He wore a pendant around his neck. This was sort of a spyglass, a burnished and perforated round plate or ring, to which he peered to behold whatever he wished, while himself remained undiscovered. This ring was probably supposed to represent another eye, by means of which Tezcatlipoca could look into the hearts of men, thus uncovering their most secret intentions. He seemed to have been called a seer, that is, he had prevision and instruments for gaining hidden knowledge. This clairvoyance is unique, for no other god is so described. Even the paired high gods do not share this uncanny and penetrating powers, and he was a trickster. Blackness was always associated with him. He was called the god of ill omen. He had 4 different regalias or transformations. The black Tezcatlipoca was the greatest of these representations. He was also called the son of the goddess, but not the firstborn. The emphasis of blackness and impenetrability is obvious, and we cannot go far wrong in seeing Tezcatlipoca as night personified, a keenly conceptualized rendering of man's fears and insecurities. There is an impressive depiction of this black Tezcatlipoca in the Selden Roll, one of the recovered codices, where he is called One Jaguar, an appropriate date name. He is shown as a warrior painted black, ensconced in the interior of the earth and wielding sacrificial knives. Thus did the artist symbolize the lethal effects of this god upon the present Camos. He's also said to have had a brother. There's a scene in Codex Borgia showing the black and the red Tezcatlipoca playing ball in one of the great courts, which leads us to believe that the latter is indeed the former's opposite, and this represents a diurnal-like divinity. In a similar vein, we find that one of the best-known transfigurations was that of the enemy. He was called Beatl, the enemy. This form, in fact, makes quite clear to us that which was basic in his nature, his role as a sower of discord among men and cities. Whenever great men humiliated others in debate, scorned them in embassy, or demeaned them, he was responsible. And he was also one responsible for making war. His single-minded concentration was on discord itself, not on the victory of any one faction. He consistently stirred up rancor so that peace should depart from the cities and war should overrun the land. At such times, blood flowed. No wonder Sargun identified him with Lucifer. He fits the description of the LDS understanding of Lucifer, his preexistence, his role, his activity, and so forth. He was the lord of battles. He had woven into his mantle an overall design of the skull and crossbones. Sometimes his mirror is shown emitting not only smoke, but also the complicated hieroglyph for divine liquid and burnt things, blood. He demanded blood. In fact, Tezcatlipoca is called left-handed, or as we might figuratively translate, he's not to be trusted. On the other hand, with no motivation whatsoever, he raises up unknown men and casts them into the empty seats of the mighty. There is no way of being sure of his continuing favor. One simply granted that his will was capricious and that he could end and would deliberately elude one. The living tokens of his power was to reduce all men to misery. Just as Tezcatlipoca laughs at the struggles of common men, so he laughs at the posturing of rulers, so-called masters of the Lord of the Earth, who he would elevate to power, men who had been born and sanctified in signs and constellations under which the Lords are born, to be instruments and images to preside over kingdoms. In this sense, there was only one ruler of all the earthly states, the God of the Kings, Tezcatlipoca. He was conceived to be the total ruler. He who pretends to be what he is not. A rather interesting parallel there to our identification of the adversary. Now, a great deal of his background and our understanding of him goes back to great antiquity, wherein he had formulated a great and vast priesthood. It followed that men were never far from him at any instance. He was revered at wayside shrines. Every house, great or small, possessed an image of him. He was truly ubiquitous. None was more astounding than his own self-creation. He was also a knowable, but he seems to have created himself in the sense of what he was, his responsibility. Not only did he make himself, but he was more vaguely the creator of all things and of all men, or so he declared. This creation he governed with constant surveillance, and no human heart could keep an ugly desire hidden from him. Yet out of this, God's wrath against his creatures might sometimes come, interestingly enough, compassion. Though we wonder if the adversary could ever have compassion as such. His work in the heavens are rather interesting. This original individual and the original eternity or time was the age of giants, the primordial race. All was on a brutal and colossal scale. The first time or the eternity itself ended only with the extinguishing of his power. Tezcatlipoca lost his power. This feat was performed by the god Quetzalcoatl, who knocked Tezcatlipoca out of the sky, whence he tumbled into the dark waters that surrounded the earth. He was cast down to the earth. We can surmise that as the centuries closed over the ancient cities, that Tezcatlipoca was the undisputed king of the gods, without rival and without peer. in the closing life of Mormon, as he sees the adversary taking over control of the earth and the individuals following Satan and Lucifer, such a tremendous parallel here. Now, an individual was forced to ascend the steps leading to the top, turning and breaking his flute and other instruments at each step. At the top, he was immediately seized by the waiting priests and sacrificed. We haven't time to go into the detail how an individual was chosen among the noble, but generally from prisoners, given a year of certain regality, and then voluntarily entered into this under some type of dope and drugs to the sacrifice. His open body was not tumbled down the steps, however, was the custom among the Aztecs, but was reverently carried down in the arms of the officiants. At the bottom, the cadaver was decapitated and defleshed, and pieces of the flesh were taken back to the city, where they were incorporated into a sacred meal given to the ruler and the princes of the state. This cannibal meal, however, had certain rituality. Now, how do we assess this particular god? We might go back to Burbage's book. He is the symbol of total rule and majesty, an evil and destructive sorcerer, a warlord, a rain withholder, a virginal young man. He had never had contact with a female. He was a seducer, a creator, a ghastly demon. He's secretive, whimsical, all-knowing, forgiving, absurd, malicious. He's invisible, ubiquitous, and final. He inhabits the night sky, caves, crossroads, reed beds, the countryside, and the city. He is everywhere. Such variety might be expected to have diluted his omnipotence, but strange enough, it did not. He is above all earthly law, but he has established no law within himself. He does not love. He does not even hate. He is simply the sheer power and will of God without his law and without his love. Pretty good summary from the ancient documents of Lucifer contained there. Now let's go to the god Quetzalcoatl. If there is any one god who is known to everyone, it is certainly this individual, a very enigmatic figure who has fascinated Western man from Cortez and the earlier friars, Franciscans, and Dominican priests down to the present. There is an explanation for this. Quetzalcoatl is the only god human enough for us to idealize among all the pantheon of 1,600 gods. There was luckily no difficulty in translating the name. It means simply plumed serpent. The plumes were so prized from the Quetzal bird to be considered precious or treasure. And additionally, depending upon the context, the ancient Aztecs used the word quetzal, meaning snake or dragon, also means twin. Thus, Quetzalcoatl can thus mean, with equal correction, either plumed serpent or precious twin. Generally, the reference to precious twin had to do with the ability of his spirit to enter into the individual like your own. He was actually fourfold also, having four representations at least. He was originally a flying dragon called the plumed serpent, his chief representation in all Central America, also the wind. He is the morning star, sometimes evening star, when he's in conflict with the adversary as the morning star. And finally, he was the priest ruler. Now, when Cortez was approaching Cholula, which was the major city, the holy city of Quetzalcoatl, the inhabitants believed that their god would infallibly protect them from any assault. They thought that if the Spaniards should so much as chip off one piece of stucco from the god's temple base, rivers of water would gush forth and drown them. But it didn't happen. We know the results in part. The Ponauco Indians are said to have been to the point where Quetzalcoatl first debarked to colonize Mesoamerica near Veracruz. This information supplants other evidence pointing to his coastal origin. Among the Panuco Indians, we also have some very early traditions that may go back into Olmec times, which could be Jaredite times. The Central Americans of the 16th century, before the, or at the time of the rival conquistadores, described this ancient god as the great star and gave him that name, Lord at the time of dawn. In fact, he was as much as the dawn as he was that star which particularly distinguished the dawn. It was sometimes said that he was the one who first brought light, being therefore older than the sun, a preexistent power, as it were. All honors were accorded him. His greatest duel has been with the other star, the day star. They're in constant conflict every day. If we remember also that the diurnal sun, we can understand that Quetzalcoatl and his many brothers are here the stars. This is interesting to identify that the many stars are brothers to this ancient priest king and god. But as a second contest, not otherwise noted, there's a presentation of the rivalry between all the other stars as well, those in particular who followed Tezcatlipoca. Here again, the ancient legends state the natural fact that the morning star does outlast the other stars, though only for a short period, thus in a sense defeating them. The morning star is here the hero, the beloved of the sun, though the enemy is the same night, and the other stars. There was often confusion in some of the pantheon of the gods about the representation of which god that the morning star was normally ascribed to. A gloss in this episode said that Quetzalcoatl disappeared for a time into the underworld, where he provided himself with darts and an atlatl. So far as we've been considering the lineaments of the ancient Mesoamerican god known to us, Quetzalcoatl and others, we are now introduced to an interesting transfiguration, who was, however, not fully divine. This god was once a living man. This was now all imperiled, for the high priest come bringing a new gospel and a reformer's zeal. In fact, we think we can see behind the sources covering this ancient god an introduction of a new and revealed religion, says one of our source materials. Mankind's guilt was gradually being purged, but sloth and envy crept in, and eventually gloom descended over the land. Omens began to appear, presaging the fall of the city, which was the ancient city of Cholulu, and the transfiguration of Tezcatlipoca, and the reinstatement of the cult of human sacrifices. He, Quetzalcoatl, had been sent down from heaven to reform men and turn them from their imperious ways. To achieve his ends, he formed a special group of priests with voices like trumpets who called the people to penance and the new light. He first went to the city, Cholulu, and practiced extreme abstinence. Now, this is an introduction. We'll have a sequel in the series, The Ancient Gods and Doctrines of Central America, and deal a great deal with other parallels that are most exciting. I think by not referring to Mormon sources and the Book of Mormon, we can still feel and see and understand the parallels that are there quite clearly. And while this is kind of interesting to know, an individual still has to go to the 10th chapter of Moroni and get an indelible witness of his own that the Book of Mormon and the doctrines of the Church of Jesus Christ are true. And then in studying those, we can find, in the proper place and proper time, the parallels to the restoration that are certainly there. Nearly all of these parallels now have only been made possible in the last 2 decades by the rediscovery and translation availability of the ancient documents of Central America. May everyone get a testimony of the Book of Mormon and the greatness of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the great Joseph who brought these forth in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.